Are you suggesting that that's what we do? We actually scrap the Chops music?
That'd be really funny
And
if we
then,
did.
and we don't even, try to layer it. Like, you just do that, and then I'll take over when you start talking, and then you take over when I start talking.
Okay, let's try it. You're listening to Pacific Underground, the show where Asians and Pacific Islanders take the mic into our own hands. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenna Yokoyama. We'll be your host for the next hour.
This month, we're talking about the mixed race experience, and not just in America. We focused in on the identity of being more than one ethnicity, race, nationality, color. The experience of not fitting neatly into one box. A life of occupying an often confusing middle ground.
We realized that folks of mixed race in a given community can have little in common except for this shared identity of having especially layered heritages. But this is often significant enough to define us and bring us together.
What we wound up with is a series of diverse stories from very different individuals. We hope you enjoy what we assembled for you.
Back to the music.
Hey, it's Kanan. I'm recording this really late at night. Just want to include a brief disclaimer here. The following interviews were recorded over the phone, so the audio quality suffered a little bit. Another thing is I think I'm getting a little sick and I can't really breathe through my nose, so my N's are going to sound like D's, and it might be a little bit more difficult to hear me at times. Thanks for putting up with me.
Like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. This is a word to describe me that isn't this weird segmented description of, you know, what my ancestors are. Like, this is just one full word, very concise to identify myself. And that was really exciting.
That's fellow podcaster and author Alex Laughlin.
Hello.
We talked over the phone recently about being mixed race. She's half Korean, I'm half Japanese. And we traded stories about our confusing experiences growing up in in-between identities. Alex wrote an article about 2 years ago for NPR's Code Switch entitled, Half Asian? Half White? No, Hapa. Hapa. You know Hapa, right? It's of Hawaiian origin, meaning literally half of something. It feels perfect in a way. No long hyphen-linked words, no disclaimers. Just a concise, two-syllable morsel. It's almost as if it was created for us, so we wouldn't any longer have to use terms that feel derogatory, ill-fitting, or in various ways sell ourselves short. I reached out to Alex because I wanted to hear from someone who also had complex, entangled feelings about the word Hapa. Here's some of our conversation.
I feel like it took me a little while to kind of warm up to it. Like, I was obviously really excited about it from the very beginning, but there's also kind of a sense of I really, really don't want to act like I am co-opting Hawaiian culture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's hard, right? Because I grew up all over the place. Hawaii is actually one of the longest places I ever lived in one place. It was Hawaii and Georgia. They're tied for the longest places I've lived, which they're very different. But So I have this feeling like, you know, I do feel really strong ties to Hawaii. Like, it has informed a lot of the way I see the world. But I'm not from Hawaii, and I feel like it's really, really important for me to acknowledge that and, you know, state that I am not necessarily one of them. So it took me a while to kind of parse my feelings about that. But ultimately, I was like, you know what? Like, this word makes me feel really great. Like, it makes me feel really, really good. So I'm just going to own it.
In kind of trying to find out how to use that word and kind of reconcile it for myself, I've been struggling a lot because there are, I mean, Hapa, it's not just one word. I mean, I saw this when I was rereading your Code Switch article, and I was looking at the comment section, and everyone who has strong feelings about the word identifies as Native Hawaiian, or like actually has that as their ethnic lineage, has like an opinion about it and has an idea of how that word ought to be used. And some people feel that it is something that is appropriative and shouldn't be used because, you know, when East Asians moved to Hawaii, they adopted the word, and that was a form of colonialism on top of the white presence there. And there's just so many ways of using that word. It can be racial, it can be totally non-racial, and like it can refer to half of anything. It can be offensive and imperialist, but it can also just be used naively, like I used it for most of my life. But how do you deal with those things when you use that word, say in company that you're not as familiar with? Do you feel like you have to be prepared to kind of justify your use of that word?
That's a really interesting question, and I'm going to give you a really heated answer. I'm often not challenged, and that's largely because I live in Washington, D.C., where there's not a huge Hawaiian diaspora. I actually do know a couple of people who either have spent time in Hawaii or Guam, and so they're, like, very familiar with these cultures, and more than anything, like, it's been sort of familiar to them. In the times that I've used it, and they've given me like the thumbs up where like it's cool. But even still, like the people I know are also East Asian, and they're also not Hapa, like they're full Korean, both of them. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I totally get it. And I do feel slight confliction, but at the same time, like I feel also that it's really important to me as an individual to be able to stake some kind of claim in my identity, because, you know, not only am I mixed culturally and ethnically or racially, but also I don't have roots anywhere. And so part of it is me trying to root myself in something and being able to say, like, yes, I'm half Korean and I'm half white. And I spent the majority of my childhood in Hawaii, and all of this can be summed up in one word, is really special to me, and it makes me feel really good to be able to say that. But also, like, it's very complicated, and, you know, I would probably have a hard time actually justifying it in conversation with somebody who's Native Hawaiian who had really, really strong feelings about it. I will say that because I'm on the East Coast, there isn't a huge, I mean, like, there are Asians on the East Coast, but, like, there are fewer people who get it on the East Coast, I think, than the West Coast. I know a lot of people on the West Coast come into contact with the word Hapa just casually, just because, like, a lot of people from Hawaii moved to the West Coast. So, like, because I'm on the East Coast and there are a lot of people that don't even know what that means, I will just defer to saying mixed. And it's like, it's really easy to just say half Korean, because that's kind of what people are getting at when they're asking about my race. So, like, and that's not, that doesn't feel like an assault on my identity if I answer that way. So, like, I'm also not opposed to doing that.
What is still challenging about kind of occupying that middle ground of being mixed race, being on the East Coast, where you probably don't come into a lot of other people who are familiar with that life story, that identity?
That's interesting. So I talked about how I was, like, I really identified myself as white when I was little, especially when I lived in Hawaii. And it wasn't until I moved away that I realized that there was this whole other part of me that was Korean, and that being Korean was not white. That was like a huge leap for me. It took me a really long time to get there, but I finally got there. And then when I started realizing that I was Korean also, and I was like just as much Korean as I was white, I felt a lot of guilt for not being Korean enough, because I had essentially lived my entire life thinking I was white, even though I was, you know, taking my shoes off when I came in the house and like eating rice with every meal and like doing very Korean things, but just not realizing it. For not being able to speak Korean, for not, like, knowing a lot of the customs,
That totally resonates with me. I often think about this idea that I really can't talk to that many people about because I don't think anyone, well, that's a little extreme, but not that many people experience it or like have put a word to it. And I haven't really found anyone else that has described it for, like, and has shared in that experience. But that's like, I call it drift, and kind of like feeling like I am getting further and further away from having a strong sense of my Japanese side, because it takes such a deliberate effort to go and put those pieces together and to spend time talking to my grandma and to my mom and like finding out my own family history in a way that doesn't come to me when I talk to my dad about, you know, how he lived in Long Island for a long time and his life story, because it's more white, and I grew up in my formative years identifying as white. So I guess, do you experience something akin to drift?
Totally, yes. I, like, it stresses me out so much that I don't know the names of my family in Korea. Like, I know their last name is Kim, and that's no help at all.
It's a common
but
one.
Yeah, like, completely. That's very much what I am worried about. You know, I also think, like, when I have kids, you know, if my kid is a quarter Korean, are they just not going to speak Korean? Are they just not going to be Korean? Like, at what point are you not Korean anymore?
Right.
I don't know.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I thought about asking about that too. But that is, it's weird, because I think, like, as mixed people, there's like a constant identity crisis happening. You never figure it out, really. I mean, not that there's ever such thing for anyone, but it's a particular dilemma. What do you think? What do you think about, do you know Kip Fulbeck and his coffee table book?
Well, I interviewed him for my Hapa piece, actually, for Code Switch.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I do know that after I discovered the word Hapa, I went on this crazy internet spree where I was searching for Hapa things everywhere. And I found this thing called 100% Hapa. And people were meant to just submit photos of themselves and be like, 50% Korean, 50% white, 100% Hapa, which is cute.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think the work Kip is doing is really cool. And I would have really loved to have had that book when I was growing up. Just like to know that people looked like me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's such a silly thing, I feel like. To like yearn to see people who look like you, but every time I see a person who is, you know, half Asian, half white, of some mix, I immediately feel this connection with them that's different from, you know, even if I see a Korean person, like, I feel more closeness and like kinship to people who are just Hapa than people who are like Korean. And I think that's because of that, like, very specific weirdness of identity where you're, like, centered in between these two cultures and you just don't know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And you're always trying to figure it out. It's very similar, actually, to being a military kid, I think. It's something that you can see in other people. My boss is actually half Chinese and half white. And I cannot tell you how good it felt to be interviewing for my job with him and just like looking across the table at him. And I was like, God, you look like my brother. This is so cool.
That's so interesting. I'm like trying to think of other things to relate to being Hapa and identifying with people that look like us, but don't really necessarily share any heritage, yet it's kind of a cultural connection in a way. And it's the mixedness, the difference. And for a long time, I didn't really understand that. I was kind of reluctant to kind of embrace the Hapa identity and connect with other people about it, because everyone's Hapa experiences can be like really different from one another's. But what everyone shares is like a sense of not fully belonging seamlessly to any particular community. And so that creates a bunch of really interesting stories and a really like vulnerable way to connect to one another. Did you feel any comfort growing up with a sibling that's also Hapa?
I suppose. I think that, honestly, my experience was so overshadowed by the angst of being a military kid that, like, the racial and ethnic anxieties were kind of secondary to me for a long time. Also, though, my sister who I grew up with is 8 years younger than me, and so we've had super different experiences.
Yeah, that's a pretty big gap.
Mm-hmm.
Do you talk to your sister about race and being mixed now?
We haven't, I don't think. I mean, so it's weird. We, like, talk about it more through, you know, proxy topics like food. You know, we eat Korean food. We love Korean food. It's great. I don't think we've ever talked explicitly, though, about, like, oh, what does it mean to be Korean and to be white and, like, to be confused? But, you know, she moved to Georgia. We've moved around a ton, right? But she went to middle school in Hawaii and then moved to Georgia. And, you know, people there were like, whoa, are you Hawaiian? Like, asking very ignorant questions because she was very dark. And, you know, looks vaguely Asian, and people couldn't place her.
Going on the theme of ignorant questions, we have a segment on our show that is about ignorance and microaggressions, and it's called Your English is So Good.
And oh, so fun.
So we have a different person on each month, and they talk about their experience kind of like generally having to do with either being asked that question or something akin to that question. Does that resonate for you? Your English is
oh,
so good.
Totally. Totally. The best thing, I mean, this has happened several times, but the best one was I was in Georgia going to pick up my dry cleaning, which, you know, stereotypes, right? Korean people usually own dry cleaners. that's the stereotype, at least. But I was going to pick up my dry cleaning, and it was this old white Southern man behind the counter, and I handed him my slip, and he was like, do you speak English, darling? And I was like, yes? And then that was all I said, and I was just completely stunned, and then got into my car and went home, and I was like, do I look like I don't speak English? Like, I'm so confused.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was weird. That was a really weird situation. But, like, weirdly, that's happened to me multiple times. People have asked if I speak English many times, which is strange because I don't think that I look that Asian.
I hate to generalize, but did those experiences happen in Georgia also, the other ones?
Yes. Yes. And then also, like, my mom often tells a story about how she was shopping in the grocery store in Kansas when I was a little baby, and a woman walked up to her and grabbed her hair and was like, you have such beautiful Chinese hair.
Oh, my God.
My mom was like, oh, God, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, nice white people who mean well, I'm sure.
Oh, you need to talk to our producer, Jenna, because she is always talking about how white people, like, reach for her hair, like, touch her hair, and her hair is like a very, very sensitive thing. She's Japanese American, and yeah, she will go on and on about how much she hates that and how much she has to deal with, like, regularly, like, in communities that she thought, like, had, you know, that got it, I guess.
Wow, I would not have thought that, but it totally makes sense.
At the end of our conversation, Alex referred me to Alicia Ramos. Alicia's the product design director for Vox Media in New York. She's half Korean as well, but also half Dominican. She also uses the word Hapa as an identifier. She has a weekly newsletter called Mixed Feelings, in which she writes about life as a female programmer, person of color, in the tech world. We talked a bit about her Hapa experience and what it's like bringing that identity into the realm of tech as a female programmer.
At the extracurricular fair in college, I saw a table for the Half Asian People's Association. And I saw that table and I was like, oh my gosh, like these are my people. I like knew it from the minute I saw them. Cause they looked like me, and I mean, they're all half Asian. Uh-huh. And I joined that club in freshman year. And then a lot, like most of my best friends, my two best friends came out of me joining that club. And it was so great. Like, it was like finally finding my tribe of people that I belonged to. Like, we weren't all the same, like, ethnicity. There were half Chinese, half Korean, half Filipino. But we all shared this common thread of, like, we don't really belong in one box. And we belong in multiple boxes. And we kind of all wanted to celebrate that and also just discuss, like, the kind of, not problems, but challenges and struggles of growing up mixed race also. So that was really awesome, and that was when I started embracing the term Hapa.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that type of solidarity is so fascinating to me, because it doesn't come out of some sort of like shared cultural norms, some sort of shared cultural lineage. It's a shared experience of not quite belonging in these boxes like you're talking about.
I mean it's pithy, and I like it. although I will say there are some terms, I know in Korea, I can't think of the word right now, but there is a word that's used for half Koreans in Korea, and it's like one of the most insulting things that you could say about someone. Like, I distinctly remembered a few years ago when I was in Korea, there was this big, like, scandal about a Korean celebrity, this woman who had to do like a big press announcement where she came out that she was half Korean and not full Korean. And it was such a big scandal, and she was crying, and the tabloids used this one very specific word to describe her as, like, I'm this word, which means half Korean. And it was such like a shameful thing. And I remember, like, watching that and feeling, like, personally hurt by that, because it sucks that in Korean culture it's, like, not great to be half Korean. I don't know if that's still true. That was a few years ago. That was maybe, like, 5-6 years ago. But it's interesting to see, like, language and how it could be derogatory, and insulting.
Right.
Like, I remember walking down the street with my mom, and like, it's so interesting, because when you're here in the States, people will look at you and be like, oh yeah, like, that girl's Asian, she's totally like full Korean. And then I will go to Korea, and I remember, like, my mom walking with me down the street and people just absolutely staring or like frowning that she had a child with a non-Korean. Like, it's totally looked down on. And then I think those attitudes started shifting a little bit as, like, Western ideals of beauty started becoming really popular in Korea. And all of a sudden, my sister and I would go to Korea as teenagers, and everyone would be like, oh my gosh, like, you guys are so pretty. You have such big eyes and small faces. And it just felt like such a huge shift, and wow. So hypocritical, because a few years ago they were the same people who were looking down on us for not being full Korean, and then we went back and all of a sudden they were praising us for our Western facial features. So yeah, it's a really different experience being mixed here versus being mixed in Korea or Japan, I bet.
And does being mixed still make its way into your life as a challenge now, in the workplace, like being in tech, being a woman, being a person of color, being a programmer?
Yeah.
How is that right now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think about this a lot. I'm a really big advocate for getting not only more women into tech, but also more people of color. And I think it's been interesting being half Asian and half Hispanic, because I think Asians and Hispanics, or Latinos, they have such a different, they live on almost opposite ends of the spectrum that people perceive about underrepresented people in tech. Like, I think people just perceive Asians as like a model minority type, and they're almost overrepresented in tech, even though the reality is that they're really not. Like, we still need more Asians in tech.
Totally.
But I think people just assume that, like, oh yeah, like, Google has a lot of Asians, and in general, there's a lot of Asians in tech. We need more Hispanics and Latinos in tech. So I think being mixed, like, across both of those races has been interesting, because I want to fight for more Hispanics and Latinos in tech and more Asians in tech. But I think more of the focus now is on getting more Hispanics and Latinos into tech and less on Asians. And so it definitely leaves me feeling very torn. But I think at the same time, it's a good opportunity for me to, like, not be a role model per se, but kind of bring light to this issue of everyone right now is underrepresented in tech, and it's not just Hispanics and Latinos, it's everyone.
How do you feel that people identify you? Do they identify you as being mixed race, or do you feel like people mention things in passing that identify you as being Asian more than Latina, Hispanic, or vice versa?
Definitely, I think people will identify me as Asian more often than not. They'll either know that I'm, or guess that I'm half Asian, or they'll think that I'm like full Filipino or Hawaiian or something. I don't think I've ever had anyone like peg me as half Hispanic. I guess it's just like my facial features look more Asian than anything. Although when I think when I wear my hair curly, that's when I get the comments on like, oh, you do look kind of Hispanic.
Oh yeah, because your hair is naturally curly, right? I think I read that on one of your posts.
Yeah, my hair is really curly naturally, but I straighten it like every day.
You still straighten it?
I do. It's pretty unruly, so.
That would be an interesting experiment, just to see if that changes.
Yeah, I think I would confuse a lot of people.
After talking to Alex and Alicia, I think I better understand that to feel inner conflict about using the word HAPA is to be more active in engaging with injustice. We didn't ask to be born HAPA. I didn't. Or to be left with a scant sense of belonging to any single community. By the same token, people of Hawaiian descent have equally zero control over the colonized history they share among themselves. I agree with both Alex and Alicia, and feel that I can celebrate my identity as mixed by using a word, while at the same time attending to the conflict that presents itself when we mindlessly adopt language that was taken from another people, and still does real harm when we use it carelessly. In my eyes, to struggle with this issue is to be awake to it, and to ignore it is a choice. I still have no idea how to avoid being complicit in hurting others with my use of the word HAPA, but by spreading the dialogue, hopefully we can avoid abusing a word that we are using as uninvited guests, not as owners, creators, or as though we were entitled to its use.
Coming up next, we take a historical look at interracial marriages and Eurasian identity. Producer Alan Montesilio interviewed Emma Tang, a professor of global studies at MIT. She delves into the history behind Chinese and European-American relationships in the mid-19th century.
In the U.S. specifically, they began to have conversations about Chinese and Euro-American, or what we might call white, intermarriage around the mid-19th century. And that coincided with the immigration of significant numbers of Chinese laborers to this country. And that's when lots of discourses about the Chinese question and other related issues. So many of those early conversations took place against the pre-existing backdrop in the United States, where there had already been essentially long-standing taboos against black and white or slave and free intermarriage or sexual relationships, even if they're outside of marriage. So there was that long-standing taboo in American culture against which a new phenomenon of interracial marriage between Chinese and Euro-Americans took place. But as I show in my book, there's also a second kind of context for this new intermarriage at that time period, which was intermarriage between European migrants and Anglo-Saxon, as they called them, American women here. And so there was, on one hand, a very strong taboo against marriage across racial lines. And on the other hand, there was an idea that intermarriage between what they were calling Native Americans, by that they meant essentially WASPs who had been in the United States for a long time.
Right.
It did not mean American Indians, which we would associate with that phrase Native American today. There was an idea that intermarriage could be a way of absorbing and assimilating those new immigrants into the mainstream of American culture.
Hmm.
And so as I show in my book, there was a real tension between those two kinds of ways of approaching intergroup unions. And some people were quite divided as to whether Chinese and white intermarriage was of the taboo interracial sort, or whether it could fall into the other paradigm of interracial intermarriage as assimilation and sort of liken Chinese and white intermarriage to, say, Roman Catholic Italian,
right,
and Protestant American intermarriage.
One of the stories that you talk about in your book is about an American woman named Mae Watkins. Could you tell me a bit more about her story?
Sure, I'd love to. Her story is one of my favorite stories, actually. It's really fascinating. So Mae Watkins was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and she met Tian Hock Franking. His name in Mandarin is Huang Tianfu. She met him while he was a student visiting from Amoy or Xiamen, China, and he was going to high school in Ann Arbor and living next door to Mae. And she mentions in her memoir, when she first saw him, she thought he was very strange and alien and very foreign to her. Later, they started to gradually become friends. She became very interested in Chinese culture and wanted to learn more about his history and background. And then gradually, they fell in love.
She was the boy next door.
Married. And so once, initially, her parents were a little bit hesitant about it. And they said, well, we think you need a cooling off period. You know, why don't you think about it for a year and then really decide? So they did, and at the end of the time period, they decided that they still were very much in love and wanted to get married. And so her parents actually blessed their marriage. Her parents were very liberal for the time. Unfortunately, what happened was that there was a huge outcry in Michigan, and the two were forced to withdraw under pressure from the University of Michigan because it was giving the school a very bad reputation. So Tim Hawk transferred to study law in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and May then decided to stay at home and become a full-time stay-at-home wife. So she never actually got to finish her degree. And then after Tim Hawk received his law degree, he realized he would have to go back to China to practice law, because under Chinese exclusion at that time, Chinese could not become naturalized as U.S. citizens. And in most states, you needed to be a citizen of the United States in order to take the bar exam. So he decided he would go back to China, and May decided that she would go with him. At that point, they already had a one-year-old son. And so the family moved back to China and lived there for several years until 1918, when Tim Hawk received a consular posting in San Francisco as a diplomat, and then the whole family returned back to San Francisco. Very tragically, however, Tim Hawk died very soon after he came back to San Francisco of influenza, and so May took her three children back home to Ann Arbor to live with her parents.
Do you have an idea what it was like for May to, you know, go to China, try to, I guess, assimilate to life in China as a European-American woman or white woman, and then to come all the way back to Michigan?
I think they had quite a difficult time adjusting to life back in the U.S., being, you know, the only so-called Chinese family on their block, really sticking out in school. Cecil mentions some racial incidents at their school where people would essentially call her a chink and things like that. So I think their adjustment was not very easy.
Mm. As you've done this research, what have you discovered or learned that has, I guess, either resonated or that you've connected to either your own, I guess, your own observations and your own experiences?
So I think that's a kind of hard question to answer,
sure.
But I can give you some sort of anecdotal answers, which is that there's a lot of quite heated discussion, especially within the last 10 years, on the internet about interracial marriage. Much of it was very heated in the late 1990s and early 2000s in particular, when there was some changes around the way that multiracial individuals were going to be counted on the census. And that became sort of a topic of public discussion. Fortunately, some of that has died down, I think, because in large part, I think, because of President Obama's example, where interracial marriages and biracial identity have become more and more normal. But looking back a couple decades, a lot of this very heated discussion centered on the unions between Chinese women or other Asian American women and white men, which became a very passionate issue for people on both sides. And what you noticed in some of the discussions that were taking place on the internet was that some people were coming up with some pretty wild theories about why these partnerings were taking place, and even some speculations about the sort of natural attraction between white men and Asian women. But all of that, I think, is pretty easily reversed when you look at history. And one of the very prominent patterns that I found during my research that a lot of people have found surprising is when you look at Chinese and Anglo-American intermarriage in the U.S. prior to World War II, the dominant form was actually Chinese men partnering with European-American women.
Hmm.
So a lot of people find that very surprising because it shakes up their stereotypes about what Chinese and white intermarriage means today.
There's this added element that I've just simply observed that mixed race and in particular half Asian or part Asian children are either exceptionally beautiful or a sign of I guess, our glorious multicultural future or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of me is also wondering where that comes from and what that means or what that reflects.
Yes, definitely. Well, I talk about that stereotypical idea also in my book, right, that really prevalent stereotype that Eurasians are the most beautiful or sometimes the most intelligent. And so I show how both on the Western side as well as the Chinese side, that goes back to some pretty troubling eugenics ideas that were popular in the late 19th century. I think a lot of people don't realize the eugenics baggage behind this idea, which is quite troubling. So in the late 19th century, there were quite a few people who were advocating that one way to improve the Chinese race was by interbreeding with whites. And so bringing in sort of an infusion of white blood to improve the Chinese race. In fact, I was just reading an article the other day in a Shanghai newspaper from 1896, and the author, who was from England, was arguing that the best way to bring about an improvement of the Chinese race is to have them intermarry with Europeans or white Americans. He was talking about, well, the nose will become more prominent, the cheekbones will be also more prominent, they'll be much better looking, and this is, in fact, the best way to bring about racial improvement. Kong Youwei, one of the most prominent Confucian thinkers of the Qing period, also had some ideas about improving the Chinese race by intermarriage with the white race. So again, he's talking both in terms of their physical looks, that this new mixed race would be taller, would have fairer skin, which was prized at that time in China, be stronger and they're better looking, but at the same time would be maintain some of the moral aspects of the Chinese race, which were very much lacking, he believed, in European imperialist races.
Is it hard not to see that? I mean, see the ways that that lines up with ideas about how to make China, I guess, strong in the face of Western imperialism?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, it was definitely within this context of trying to make China stronger against the imperialist powers of the time, and very much influenced by social Darwinism, which had been imported into China during that time period.
Next up is commentary from Ellie Nakayama, one of the members of KBOO's Youth Collective. We thought it'd be a great idea to talk to someone with a bit of a younger perspective on the mixed race experience.
I think that people don't know my race and they always ask me, oh, wow, you're Asian. Like, I didn't expect that. I thought your dad was Hispanic and I thought you were Hispanic. Instead of being like, oh, well, you're just a human being and I shouldn't think that, oh, you're a certain way because you're Asian or you're part Asian or you're like, quote unquote, like mixed blood or like stuff like that.
Do people use the word mixed blood?
I've talked to one person. They were really rude about it. I think some people believe that you shouldn't mix races, which is a really old thing, like a really old timey thing. But some people still believe that. And there was like this old lady and she's like, oh, you're Asian. She's like, you're part Asian? She's like, oh, that's really not okay. Like, why are you mixed blood? I think that was a long time ago.
Who is this person? I mean, what was their background that they're telling you that?
She was just this old lady who was at my grandma's old folks' home. And she's very old school, very, very old school. It's kind of like...
But I find it really interesting that you didn't outright say that this old generation lady is white.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think people... I don't know, not expected, but, I mean, she is white, but she's not, I just didn't say that she was white because it's like, oh, I mean, not all white people are racist, but not all, I don't usually see people of other races saying stuff like this, you know?
You were listening to Ellie Nakayama, one of the members of KBOO's Youth Collective. We thought it'd be a great idea to talk to someone with a younger perspective. Hey, you're listening to Pacific Underground. I'm Kanan Schlesinger, one of your hosts this month. If you're just tuning in or haven't been paying attention till now, this month's episode is about being mixed race API, Asian Pacific Islander. You just heard interviews with Alex Laughlin with The Washington Post and the LadyCast podcast, and Alicia Ramos, product design director at Vox Media. Then it was Alan Montesilio interviewing MIT Global Studies professor Emma Tang, followed by KBOO Youth Collective member Ellie Nakayama. Stay tuned for an interview with Winton White, who will be sharing his perspective on being mixed race in Japan. Thanks for listening. In an earlier segment, we explored the word hapa. For this next segment, producer Jenna Yokoyama takes a look at a similar word, hafu, the word used in Japan to describe people with a mixed background.
When the Pacific Underground crew first started talking about having an episode about mixed race identity, I immediately thought of my days back in grad school, so many years ago, where I encountered Winton White, the first HAFU person I ever met. What's HAFU? HAFU is an identity for mixed-race people in Japan. To help me explain the word, I called up that same person from grad school.
The word HAFU derives from the English word half, and most English speakers, when they do hear the term HAFU, they think half as well.
That's Winton.
Here's the thing, is that whenever Japanese people say HAFU, we're not thinking hanbun, which is half in Japanese. We don't think that. HAFU in itself is a term used for our identity as somebody who is a mix of Japanese and another race. So it's like its own identity. It's not Asian, it's not white, it's not black, it's not Latino, it's just, it's HAFU. Like that was, it was like it's a race of its own.
Let's back it up here to the beginning of the interview to give some background. Winton was born in upstate New York to an American father and Japanese mother. He was raised and educated in Japan.
But not a Japanese school. I attended an American school on an American Navy base. So my entire education has been American, from elementary school throughout high school.
He moved to the United States for college in the early 2000s and only recently moved back to Japan. He now lives in his hometown just outside of Tokyo, which is where I caught up with him via Skype. Winton is a singer, composer, occasional YouTuber, and a microbeer fanatic. Okay, enough of me talking. Let's get back to the interview. Do you think of yourself as more like American or more Japanese?
Yeah, I guess this is where I kind of go back and forth with it. And here's the thing, like how my personality is probably more conducive to the American culture. I just tend to be very expressive, very outspoken, very open. Just like I love talking with people. Not like Japanese people don't, but just very extroverted. And the Japanese culture as a whole is very much an introverted, passive culture. I guess the struggle that I had was just wanting to be Japanese as much as I can. And that has to do with being picked on and bullied and being pushed away by Japanese kids when I was young. This was before and even a little bit during elementary school. I would hang out with the kids in my neighborhood, and you know I would always want to be around people and kids and all that. But they would eventually pick on me, and they just kind of keep me separated from them. Now, when I was a kid dealing with that, that's not because I was HAFU. I was really thinking about it, and I was like, you know what, it's not because I'm mixed race, because the thing is that kids, if they want to pick on you, they'll find everything possible to distinguish you from their group or their whatever, right? So for me, it was just an easy target because of my mixed race. There was another girl who's full Japanese. She was picked on too because she went to a different elementary school as the other girls. So it's like that kind of stupid, ignorant, closed-mindedness that can happen in any society. But I think in Japan, it's a little more prominent because it's very much a conformist culture. I don't remember it much. Actually, my mom said that I used to come back home crying almost every day because the kids in the neighborhood would pick on me. It sounds so sad, you know? Like, coming home every day crying because I'm not accepted. They don't accept me as a human being, you know? But it's like, I don't remember any of it. It's like embedded in my psyche. It's going to come out when I'm 45 and I'm just going to have a breakdown, probably.
So what was it like when you were growing up in your home? Like, what kind of foods did you eat?
Food-wise, I guess it was a good half and half. Because my dad, being an American, he wanted his steak, and he wanted his lasagna and pasta and all that. And so, I would say it was a good mix of both. And because we couldn't get turkey here at the time, so during Thanksgiving, we'd have Thanksgiving sushi instead. Yeah, so it was a good mix. And as far as even just experience-wise, we spoke English most of the time at home. Well, it's just because my dad talks a lot and my mom doesn't talk at all. That's simply the reason why. My mom's like as Japanese as you could think, as far as just being really quiet and, you know, being the good housewife and the mother, too. My dad just go out and work, but he's just like the talker. So he's just like English. But we actually grew up speaking both at the same time. We would mix it. Some people might call it, or was it? We say champong, like speaking champong, which is basically like a mixed hot pot is what champong is. You just put a lot of stuff in the hot pot. But it made conversations just so much more, I guess, fun. I would speak, you know, champong with my other Hafu friends or bilingual friends. And it's funny. It's so fun because we mix both. And just depending on what word, you know, verb, adjective, we kind of, it's just total mix. And sometimes we'd speak Japanese with an English or American accent or English with a Japanese accent. So you end up having almost four different dimensions within one sentence sometimes. And we just, like, we laugh just because it's ridiculous. But that was really fun. But because of that, both languages were kind of on this mediocre side. So when I moved to America, my English improved quite a bit.
Did you know a lot of other Hafu kids growing up?
Yeah, I did, actually. Most of the half-Japanese kids would hang out with each other. Consequently, for some reason, I didn't really. I had friends that were, but I didn't really hang out with them. Now, after high school, I ended up finding some websites. Actually, there were two. One called Hapa Japan and Havzi.com. And that's where a community of people that are half Japanese and half whatever else would communicate with each other. And people would end up meeting up online. And the first one I had was, it was in Tokyo. It was a Hapa Japan group. And man, the only half Japanese people I knew were half American and half Japanese. But I met like a half Brit, half Swedish, half Ethiopian, and just a variety of kind. Like there's this one guy named Daniel. When we spoke in Japanese, we had the same Japanese dialect, the Tokyo dialect. But when we switched to English, he's like all of a sudden like very London British kind of English. And I'm like, whoa, I'm used to hearing American English from a Hafu person, right? But instead it's like very British. And there's one girl named Helen that I met. She's half Swedish. But see, I didn't know that. And I swear she was from Minnesota. I swear. I was like, she has to be from Minnesota. This is like 2003 or so. After I watched Fargo. And I was like, oh, she's totally Minnesota, right? And I was like, where are you from? Without assuming, right? And she's like, oh, I'm from Sweden. I was like, oh, okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. So it was really interesting. I just loved it. I just loved how mixed it was, how much variety there was, and exchanging thoughts with people of different background and mixes. And I loved it.
So as there's more and more Hafu people in Japan, do you see Japan becoming more accepting of Hafu people? Is it becoming more progressive in that sense?
I guess the quick answer would be yes. Yeah, it is. It is moving forward, but it is moving very slow. As far as, well, here, this, just to give you some perspective, how I experienced as someone who's Hafu in Japan, and then I moved to America. I was gone for 15 years, and during that time, people have told me, it's like, man, there's more Hafu celebrities on TV now, like more than usual. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. So I was expecting a noticeable change. But when I came back last year, like as far as how I was treated, just the kind of conversations I would have with the Japanese people, wasn't really that noticeable. So I was like, I don't think much has changed, really. So in that sense, that's why I say the change is really slow. But it is there. Just having more foreigners on Japanese TV, bringing up about mixed race, interracial marriages too, it has changed quite a bit. And it is cool to see more Hafu celebrities, but they kind of have to play that role that I'm Hafu, and they can't really have a Japanese name too, because that'll kind of seem weird to Japanese people. Like when I used to introduce myself as Yuichiro, that's my Japanese name, Yuichiro. And nowadays, whenever I introduce myself as Yuichiro to adults who are Japanese, they kind of laugh or chuckle, because to them there's this huge gap between how I look and having a Japanese, very Japanese name like Yuichiro. When you're dealing with those kind of experiences, you have to see it from the Japanese perspective. Even I have to. Like, I grew up here and I still have to kind of readjust how I see things and be like, oh yeah, because I'm in Japan. Or, oh yeah, because of Japan. because here's the thing, is that when I don't see many things like that as racist or remotely racist is because the intention behind it. Now, there are, ignorance is involved, for sure. The purest term of that word is you just don't know. You know, how can you be mad at someone who just didn't know? And you have to consider every experience, as repetitive as it is, as an opportunity to educate people. And, you know, as we know, people don't learn just on one shot. You know, sometimes you have to repeat yourself with the same person. But yeah, like, I experience those kind of things a lot. Yeah, I used to get really mad about it, but not anymore. For me now, I think it was around last year when I was like, you know what? I don't care if I'm like being fully accepted or not or whatever, I'm myself. And, you know, at the age of 34, it's like I finally arrived to that. But it's good to know that I kind of went through that to be like, you know what? I'm myself. I don't care if I'm fully accepted as Japanese or rejected or as American or not. I'm just myself. And so right after that, a couple months later, I ended up moving back to Japan, and I didn't really have to kind of deal with that inner struggle and stuff. So now I'm just kind of, I still consider myself hafu, as both Japanese, not half Japanese, half American, but both Japanese and American. But, you know, I may veer more towards one side than the other, and maybe it depends on the day too.
That was Winton White speaking to me from across the pond from just outside of Tokyo, Japan. Winton is a musician, a composer. In fact, he wrote the music you're listening to right now. So if you want to hear more of his music, you can find him on SoundCloud at Winton White. Also, check out the documentary Hafu to hear his film score. Hafu is a film that explores the modern Hafu experience in Japan. You can find that on Vimeo or at hafufilm.com. It's spelled H-A-F-U. Well, that's the end of our show. We hope you enjoyed hearing about the mixed race experience. This week's episode was produced by Kanan Schlesinger. Pacific Underground is Alan Montesilio, Tabitha Teo, Kanan Schlesinger, Pamela Santos, and me, Jenny Yokoyama. Thank you to the whole Pacific Underground team, our engineer, Sam Parrish, and our Morning Public Affairs director, Kathleen Stevenson. As always, thanks also to KBOO for the love, support, space, and equipment.
Special thanks to our guest this week, Alex Laughlin. You can find more of her work at theladycast.com. Alicia Ramos. You can subscribe to her newsletter at aliciaramos.com. That's aliciaramos.com. Ellie Nakayama, Professor Emma Tang, and Winton White in Japan. Thanks also to Chops for our theme music, plus Anna Vo, whose music you heard in the Hoppe segment. More at anavo.bandcamp.com. Beat by DJ Kutsu. Look him up on SoundCloud, KUTZU, and Hans Araki, the half-Irish, half-Japanese artist whose Celtic music you heard at multiple points in our show. More at hanzaraki.com. If you enjoyed this month's episode, please be sure to subscribe to our show on iTunes. We'll be releasing two additional segments on Mixed, Miss in the next 2 weeks. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll catch you next time.